Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Science Behind Science podcast. In this episode, we will be discussing if it is possible to de-extinct a dinosaur. We will also hear Steve Agard evaluate the future of NASA. But first, on to the Science Behind Science segment of this episode, where we will be talking about the science behind the strong nuclear force. To understand what the strong nuclear force is, we need to know the definition of a few key words. A proton is a positively charged particle, an electron is a small, negatively charged particle, and a neutron is a neutrally charged particle. We also need to understand that particles with the same charge repel each other, whilst particles with opposite charges attract each other. An atom is composed of a nucleus being orbited by electrons. Protons and neutrons are both found in the nucleus. They are defined as nucleons. The nucleons are very close together. This means that protons will be in close proximity to other protons. And because particles with the same charge will repel each other, theoretically the nucleus would not be able to stay intact. But the nucleus does stay intact. And this is because of the strong nuclear force. The strong nuclear force only works on a very short range, and will have little effect at spacings over 3 femtometers. A femtometer is 1 times 10 to the power of negative 15 meters. In other words, this is 0 point, followed by 14 zeros, and then 1. The strong nuclear force is attractive from 3 femtometers until 0.5 of a femtometer. After this, it becomes highly repulsive. This is to prevent the nucleus from collapsing. Of the 4 fundamental forces, the strong nuclear force is the strongest, followed by electromagnetic force, weak nuclear force, and then gravity. If the strong nuclear force wasn't as strong as the electromagnetic force, it means the attractive force between the protons in the nucleus would not be strong enough to overcome the electromagnetic repulsion, meaning that the nucleus would never be able to stay intact. And that is the science behind the strong nuclear force. If you want any more information about it, feel free to email me at sciencebehindsciencepod@gmail.com. Now, on to A Voice Behind Science, where in this episode, Steve Agard talks to us about the future of NASA. NASA announced in March that they'll be going to the moon by 2024. Do you think that date is realistic?
Well, it's possible if we get all the requested funds and we have a successful development and testing of all the different elements. We have an awful lot of things we would have to do. We have lots of different companies that are working on it right now. Lots of different contracts have already been awarded. But you know, that is what we call a green light thing. If you were to ask me in 1961, do you think we can land on the moon in 8 years when we only had 15 minutes of experience in space? I remember President Kennedy once saying that we are absolutely depending on metals that haven't been invented yet. Well, that's kind of a leap of faith there. And again, this is you're talking about another 5 years for us to be able to do that. It took 8 to go to the moon the first time, and we didn't. Werner von Braun used to joke that the only thing we knew about space when he started in the space program was that space appeared to be bigger than the American state of Texas, which tells you that we really didn't know all that much about space. Our knowledge has improved, you know, so much more. With so much, I mean, we had to worry about in the space program, you know, was a landing craft going to sink into the moon because of the amount of dust? We were worried about a lot of different things that we don't have to worry about this time. But are we going to get the funding we need? Are we going to get all the different elements to work together? You know, that's still unknown, but we got a 5-year target, and a lot of that is underway, you know, right now. Whether we make it or not, well, that depends on how things go. But we're going to need the funds, and we're going to need successful testing and just a little bit of luck as well.
And why are NASA going to the moon again?
Okay, why go to the moon again? Well, the first time we went, the longest flights were about 3 days on the lunar surface. The last time we went was in December of 1972. That's nearly 50 years ago. Now, all you have to do is go to your local library, get a book that's more than 10 years old, and it will have in big print, "The Moon Has No Water." Well, we decided and we found out the moon has lots of water. So the last time we were on the moon, we didn't even know it had water. Lots of different countries and industries want to go to the south pole of the moon, an area called Shackleton Crater. Shackleton Crater, of course, is named after the British explorer Ernest Shackleton. It's almost exactly at the south pole of the moon. And because of the depth of the crater, there's some ice inside the crater. And because the moon is not tilted on its axis very much, it's about a little over a degree. We're 23 degrees, 23 and a half. The inside of that crater has never, ever seen sunlight. On the other hand, the outside of the crater is almost always in sunlight. So you'd have pretty much free power and water. What a great place. The north pole of the moon, the same thing. So we know so much about the moon now that we didn't know a half century ago. So it would be like exploring the Earth but only making 6 quick trips. You really wouldn't have a very good feel for planet Earth. Well, what's to say the moon isn't the same thing? It's only a 3-day trip. And once we learn how to use that environment, when we talk about the American West, we talk about people, you know, going out to, you know, a 2,500-mile trip to California from the East Coast. They didn't bring trees with them to make houses. They used the local trees. So what we're hoping to do is, okay, we have all this lunar material. How can we work with it to build things? So that's what we want to do. The target goal right now is in 2020, which is by the end of next year or early the following year, the new rocket, the Space Launch System. We want to have that launched. 2 years later, send a crew around the moon in the Orion capsule. 2 years after that, 2024, have a landing on the moon. And shortly after that, a permanent presence on the moon, something like we have on the space station. You know, have people there all the time, cycling on and off. And the more you're on the moon, the more you're going to learn about different things. And once you learn all these different things, what could we get from this area of the moon? What materials are we very rich in this area of the moon? Well, one of the big things I remember talking about the planet Mars when we were talking about that 30 years ago is, my goodness, if you go to Mars and you break or lose your screwdriver, the closest screwdriver is 30 million miles away. Well, now we have 3D printing. We can make tools while we're there. Just send the instructions and we could create a tool. We have a 3D printer on the space station right now. Well, all of a sudden, now you don't have to worry about leaving certain things behind. You could make the tool that you want right there. So there's so many capabilities we have now we did not have in 1972. We just barely had the calculator invented in 1972. So we have, you know, there's so much more we can do on the moon now. And then after that, going from the moon someplace else to Mars, for example, it's a lot easier getting off the moon than it is getting off the Earth, 1/6 the gravity. No air resistance that we have to worry about. So there's a lot of different aspects. Astronomy from the other side of the moon, the far side of the moon, you're completely blocked off from the Earth's radio signals. So you can do radio astronomy a lot differently. So there's lots of different advantages the moon has.
And you mentioned in the prior question about the special launch system. What is so special about it?
All right, the Space Launch System. The way that the Space Launch System is very big. It's more powerful than the Saturn V moon rocket. And the thing that they like to talk about is right now that would be the government's launch vehicle. Now we have, you know, private industry. Blue Origin has the New Glenn rocket. The SpaceX company has the Falcon Heavy, and very shortly the Big Falcon rocket, the Starliner, the Starship. But they're private companies, and the good part about that is they can develop things on their own because it's a private company. The bad thing about that is if they decide not to, well, there's no government agency. So NASA has a government agency that's supporting this. So the idea is the Space Launch System can launch heavier payloads. If you can launch a heavier payload, that means you can put up more in one flight. The other vehicles can put up less. So the chance of having an accident in 10 flights is more than the chance of having an accident in 2 or 3 flights. To give you an example, the space station weighs about 1 million pounds. Well, with a space shuttle, you could take up about 50,000 pounds at the very most at a time. So that would be about, comes out to about at least 20 flights if you had them fully loaded to build the space station. Well, a Saturn V would be able to do the same thing in 4 flights, carry up about 1 million pounds. So the idea is if you have a vehicle that can carry more in one time, the chance of an accident are less. But because, again, you can launch more at the same time. So that was one of the justifications NASA uses for launching the Space Launch System. But having the Blue Origin system, which is the New Glenn rocket, having the Starship, which is from SpaceX, Delta IV Heavy from the United Launch Alliance to launch heavier payloads, the more different systems you have, the more chances you have to launch different types of aspects of the entire program. So the Space Launch System is the biggest of these right now that are, you know, in serious development. And again, that one's only about 1.5 years from launch right now.
Will the rocket being used for these missions be reusable like you see SpaceX rockets?
No, the Space Launch System is not. Now, neither are the solid rocket boosters. Now, people say, well, wait a minute, you used to be able to recover the solid rocket boosters. Why can't you recover them anymore? Well, the solid rocket boosters are very, very similar to the ones on the space shuttle. The space shuttle ones were 4 segments high. These are 5. Well, that seems very inconsequential. What's the difference? And the idea is, well, our launch rate isn't going to be as high. We're not going to be launching them every other month like the space shuttle. It's going to be way greater amount of time between launches. So if we wanted to reuse these, we would have to keep a whole workforce like we did for the space shuttle program to operate the ships that go out, the people that refurbish the boosters. So you're keeping that whole workforce employed for many, many months or sometimes a year between flights. So they decided it would be cheaper to build every one of these components for one-time use. Since you don't have a very rapid turnaround like on the space shuttle program, you needed to launch these vehicles. Sometimes our record was, I believe, 10 missions in a year. So you needed to quickly get those boosters back, quickly fill them with fuel. You had a whole team of people doing all that work. Here, we're not going to be planning nearly as many flights. So to keep that whole workforce that's not going to be working all the time was considered not economical.
Okay, and how long do you think it will take to colonize the Moon and Mars?
Well, the Moon, again, we're trying to set up the slogan right now is this time we're going to the Moon to stay, not a flag and footprint thing. But they're saying, you know, the later part of this next decade, in the mid-2020s, the later 2020s, starting to send up, you know, creating a moon base. How big it is, I don't think we've decided something like that yet. Mars, we're not talking about a landing attempt until the 2030s, which, again, is about 15 years or so. And again, we're going to have to assume an international base to do that. Landing on Mars, a lot tougher than landing on the Moon. One of the good things and bad things about the Moon, it doesn't have an atmosphere, so you can design a craft any way you want. On the other hand, Mars does have a little bit of an atmosphere, but it also has wind, and it also has a lot of particles. So there's good things and bad things. It has a lot more resources than the Moon has. So we can use part of Mars's environment to help us make rocket propellant. So there's a lot of advantages and a lot of disadvantages of Mars as well. You have the ice caps there with water. So there is a lot of advantages, a lot of disadvantage about Mars. And again, Mars is much further away, so it's going to be a lot more complicated to do the missions. But one thing is not One thing is, very different from the other. We shouldn't, put these things at odds against each other. It's not a Moon or Mars thing. I don't see any reason why you can't do both. And with this great commitment to open up every part of our solar system.
Finally, to send a rocket to Mars with this system, you'd have to fly the rocket to the Moon first or transport it. Would you fly the whole rocket with everything attached to the Moon first, or would you send it up in parts?
Those decisions haven't been made right yet. I mean, on the new, what we call the new Artemis program, which is the new name of what the old program was called Apollo, we would have a station around the Moon called the Gateway, and we would have craft land on the Moon, go up to this Gateway station, be refueled, go down again, come back up again. So it'd be like almost like a taxi service between the ground and the Gateway. And the idea is, once you have this station, the idea is to build bigger craft there that can make that trip to Mars. There's lots of different what we call architectures that are being developed right now. Lots of different companies have different ideas of how do you land something on Mars. We have rocket people like Robert Zubrin that says, well, you could actually put a processing plant to make rocket propellant on Mars before you actually get down to the surface of Mars. Now, one of the things, if you remember in the Apollo program, you're trying to make a landing on the Moon, and there's no runways. It's the Moon. You have nothing down there. Hopefully, you get a good place to make a landing. Well, once you decide you're going to have a Moon base, one of the first things you might want to do is make a landing pad. And now you have radar that can guide you down. Look at SpaceX. They're landing on Earth, which is a lot more complicated than landing on the Moon, and you're able to land on a landing pad. Well, there won't be any problem about landing on the Moon with a landing pad, because there's a place that you know you're going to land at. And so all these things we can learn from both the Moon and Mars. And the more we learn, the more we're going to be in a position to learn even more, because you start learning more about your capabilities and more of what you're going to be able to do as you use what they call in situ, or stuff that's located in the immediate area. Hey, this rock contains such and such a material. We can use that to make this. And then something else is learned. So you get to have more and more resources. For the greatest amount of history of mankind, oil didn't mean anything. And all of a sudden now, oil is how you fuel cars. Well, 200 years ago, if you sat on millions of tons of oil, it meant absolutely nothing. Now, all of a sudden, well, oil is what makes a big country big and great. And, so how you use the resources you have and the resources you find are so very important.
So it's a very bright future for NASA then.
I think so. And for the space agency, both here in the United States and throughout the world. And I think that's very important, to have people from all over contributing all types of different ideas, to take that full human experience on Earth and apply it to the future. And that is, I think, once we learn to depend more on each other to do these great accomplishments, learning how to work together in space probably will help us succeed a little bit more doing that on Earth.
Steve, thank you very much.
And thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
I'd just like to say thank you very much to Steve, who gave up his time to do the four interviews for this season's section of A Voice Behind Science. In this episode's section of The Science Behind Films, we will discuss if it is possible to de-extinct a dinosaur. The idea of bringing dinosaurs out of extinction, like in Jurassic Park, is pretty cool, but is it possible? You'd probably be thinking that the technology required to de-extinct an animal is far more advanced than the technology we have now. But the truth is that a de-extinction experiment has already been done, and was successful, kind of. A Pyrenean ibex specimen was brought back from extinction in 2003, where scientists took the nucleus from a tissue cell from the last living specimen and implanted it into a goat egg that its nucleus had been removed. They then implanted the egg into a surrogate goat and waited for cell division to start. The ibex was born, however, it died of a lung defect just after birth. So the experiment was kind of successful. But what about dinosaurs? Can we de-extinct them? Unfortunately, scientists don't think it is possible. This is because they believe that the DNA degradation would be too severe to recover enough DNA to clone the dinosaur. Morten Allentoft of Denmark's Natural History Museum said that it takes just over 500 years for half the DNA molecules in a strand of DNA to have decomposed into something unrecognizable. And because dinosaurs are 65 to 230 million years old, there won't be enough DNA left to clone them. And the Jurassic Park theory, in which you extract dinosaur DNA from a mosquito, won't seem to work either. David Penny of the University of Manchester discovered that DNA degrades faster when in tree sap than if the specimen was air-dried. So it seems impossible to de-extinct a dinosaur, but they are trying. Scientists at Yale University are creating dino chickens. They've managed to make chickens grow a dinosaur-looking fibula, which is a long thin bone extending from the knee to the ankle. They did this by inhibiting a gene called Indian hedgehog, but it gets better. They've also managed to block proteins that cause the two nose bones from joining together and creating a beak. This makes the chicken's head resemble one of the Velociraptor. I know these dino chickens are no T-Rex, but at least that's something. And there we are. We have reached the end of this episode and season of the Science Behind Science podcast. I'd just like to say thank you to, of course, Steve Agard for letting me interview him, but also to Cambridge 105 radio station for letting me use their studios to record the podcast. If you want me to talk about a certain topic in the next season of the podcast, then be sure to contact me. You can email me at sciencebehindsciencepod@gmail.com. You can tweet me at sbehindspod, or you could direct message me on Instagram at sbs-pc. If you're feeling generous, feel free to visit the podcast's Patreon page. You can find this in the podcast's Twitter bio. If you want some general information about the podcast, you can visit our website. You can find it at www.sbs-pc.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next season.